we only have one item on the agenda. That is the consideration of the legal opinion. Honorable members, the meeting has started already. I expect us to, even if we are still standing, we must stand with the notion that the meeting is on. I was saying that we have only one item on our agenda, that will be the consideration of the legal opinion, as it was requested from this committee. This legal opinion is not the bill, it's not an ombudsman bill, it's a legal opinion. I'm aware that most of members might not have gone through it. But that's not the problem now, because the legal advisors will take us through the bill, will make our comments, and also a question of clarifications. And we hope the purpose of the bill is that it will inform members who will go and go through the bill in their own time. The purpose will be the bill will help members when we go to the clause by clause consideration of the opinion. We have members when we go to clause by clause consideration of the bill. That I think this is the information which is supposed to arm you when we go to clause consideration of the bill. And I'm giving. I'm not sure you are going to give us a presentation, Vanara. And over to you, Vanara.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, and good morning to yourself and the Honorable members, your guests, and officials from the department. My name is Ndutuzalo Vanara. I am the Senior Parliamentary Legal Advisor. I am with my colleague, Ms. Suan Isaac, who is our Parliamentary Legal Advisor. We were requested by the committee to advise on whether or not the Military Ombuds Bill is sufficiently independent. The presentation will be done by my colleague. However, as an overview of her presentation, I'd like to just point out to the members that the assessment of the independence was not based on the test used to determine judicial independence. We have used the test that is ascribed to Chapter 9 institutions. The reason for that is precisely because there is no constitutional obligation on the legislature to create an independent military ombuds. However, if our understanding is that it is the intention of the committee to create an independent body, we then looked at the matter. The presentation is going to look at the test that we've looked at, how we've applied it to the bill. We will point out the areas where we are of the view that the bill meets certain, some of the provisions of the bill meet the test, and will also point out those provisions that we are of the view that in order for them to meet the independence tests that we've applied, they will have to be enhanced and improved. And in those instances, we have made certain recommendations for the committee. Without taking much of the committee's time, I'll now hand over to my colleague to do her presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Good morning to the chairperson and members of the committee. I just want the committee, make the committee aware of the documents that are required. It's the legal opinion, which is a lengthy document, and the presentation. Unfortunately, we don't have access to computer to do the presentation up on the screen, but the presentation is this document. Just to pick up from where Mr. Vunara left off, committee has requested we just assess the independence of the military ombuds. So the opinion has been divided into two parts, and I'm going to refer to paragraphs within the opinion for ease of reference for members. The first part of the opinion provides a broad overview of what independence means in respect to an office of an ombud. And secondly, we look at these criteria and apply it as to the present bill to determine what level of independence the present the ombud that is intended to be created does have. I refer to point paragraph 3, the general overview in the opinion. And the general idea of what an ombud is, it is a body created by the constitution or the legislature, which is serviced by a high-level public official who is responsible to the legislature and parliament and who receives complaints from aggrieved persons against government agencies and is able to investigate and make recommendations. Now, historically, an ombud is someone who seeks to protect citizens from government action, and the most notable examples of an ombud in South Africa are the public protector. In paragraph 5 of the opinion, I note various characteristics that are associated by an ombud as put forward by Hoekstra. And further down in paragraph 6, I refer to guidelines that have been used by the United States Ombud Association in the establishment of an ombud. Some of the guidelines that are used include independence, impartiality and fairness, credibility in the review process, which refers to the investigative process, and lastly, confidentiality of information. Now, the above characteristics and guidelines may be useful in the committee, useful to the committee in determining whether the ombud meets the standard for adequate independence in discharging its mandate. As Mr. Vunara has already said, there is no objective or predefined criteria as to what constitutes an independent body. This body may be as independent as Parliament intends for it to be. However, it is our submission that once the mandate of the body is determined, there must be a concurrent level of independence given to it for it to be able to fulfill its functions. In assessing independence, I have summarized it or broken it down into three broad criteria. Firstly, we need to look at the context in which the ombud operates in. Secondly, we need to look at the form and structure of the ombud as to whether it gives effect to the independence. And thirdly, we need to determine what would be the public perception of this independence. I refer to paragraph 9 of the opinion. Independence is contextual and depends on the mandate and purpose of the body. So the degree of independence required of a judicial officer is immensely different from the independence required from a presiding officer in a disciplinary hearing. We submit, therefore, in considering whether or not the ombud is adequately independent, the committee must consider its mandate and the context in which it operates. Further, with regard to form and structure in paragraph 12, we note that form and structure is essential to the independence of the entity. We differentiate between independence and impartiality. Impartiality refers to the state of mind of the official conducting an investigation, while independence can be either the independence of the official and more broadly, institutional independence. Now, I'm going to discuss what institutional independence is and I refer to paragraph 14 of the opinion. Institutional independence is a question of what form and structure an entity takes in relationship to the executive. Institutional independence also refers to the quality of this relationship. In determining institutional independence, consideration must be given to the following aspects. How is the head of this institution appointed and removed? Who appoints the staff? Is there security of tenure? Is there financial security in terms of, and further, is there security in terms of conditions of employment? Who does the person report to? Who funds the entity? And is there real institutional independence? We note that bodies such as the Military Ombud may be established according to various criteria, and this must be determined by the context it operates in. In paragraph 17, we also note that the appointment by an executive of a person does not automatically mean that the appointee will not act independently or impartially. In paragraph 19, we refer to the judgment of Glenister, wherein the court said, adequate independence does not mean insulation from political accountability, but a degree of insulation from management by political actors that may threaten the independent functioning of the entity. It is hence our view that the greater the need for the entity to be institutionally independent, the greater the need for protection from political management that may interfere with this independence. I then turn to the concept of public perception in 21. Our courts have continuously noted that public perception is a key criteria to determine independence. The Constitutional Court has stated, appearance or perception of independence plays an important role in evaluating whether independence in fact exists. And in paragraph 23, the Glenister case sets out what the court has said in detail. Therefore, in considering whether the Ombud is an independent entity, the committee must also consider what is the public perception of the entity's independence. I now turn to applying these factors to the bill before us. Firstly, as Mr. Vanara has already said, there is no constitutional duty to establish the Ombud or an independent Ombud. Parliament has the prerogative to create this body and may set the independence as it sees fit, but this independence must obviously give effect to the mandate of the body. The next question that arises is whether the provisions of the bill create an Ombud that is adequately independent to fulfill its mandate. So I'm now going to look at certain clauses and ask the question, is the power given to the Ombud sufficient to enable it to carry out its function? I look at clause 1, which is the definition of complaints. It is our submission that the definition does not set out the jurisdiction of the Ombud. A clear expression of the mandate of the Ombud will enable it to exercise its authority over a clearly defined area and how it entrenches its independence. We also note that the Ombud is restricted to investigating individual complaints, and the Ombud is not enabled to initiate investigations. In paragraph 31, we note, as an aside, that the definition of complaint does not put into clause 7, and this is something the committee may consider during its deliberations. Regarding the object of the office in clause 3, paragraph 32, we submit that while this does create an impression of independence, we are of the opinion that the word impartial and independence also be included in the objects. This will clearly set out the objectives of the Ombud as being independent and impartial. We take guidance for this point of view from our constitution with regards to the manner in which it describes chapter 9 bodies. And I refer to paragraph 34, which deals with the appointment of the military ombuds. Now, one of the areas of contention in the submission was with regard to the appointment of the ombuds. At present, the president appoints the ombuds. The president must appoint a person as a military ombuds, a person who has possession of adequate knowledge of the Constitution and military and public administrative experience. Under normal or in terms of international best practice, it is not proper for the reviewing body or the body that the ombuds reviews to appoint the ombuds. So, for example, it is not proper in terms of best practice for the minister to appoint the ombuds. In this instance, the president makes the appointment. However, and taking into consideration some of the submissions, this may still be seen as the executive making the appointment and may not lend to the fact that the ombuds is an independent institution and may create an impression that the ombud will be biased to the executive. It is our suggestion that Parliament or the committee consider a greater role for Parliament in the appointment process. For this, we look for guidance to our Chapter 9 bodies, and we note that there's a lot in terms of the appointment of the public protector, for example. There's the involvement of the National Assembly, and the President appoints on the recommendation of the National Assembly. In paragraph 37, I also draw an example of the Independent Police Investigative Directorate. Here, the Executive Director of IPED is nominated by the Minister, and the nomination is confirmed by the Parliamentary Committee. So it's basically about ensuring that there is involvement of Parliament, so the body can have be seen as more independent than it may be currently be seen. And I refer to the term of office in paragraph 40. We note that the ombud is appointed for a non-renewable period of 5 years. A fixed term is in keeping with international best practice and it ensures security of tenure for the ombud. There have been suggestions that the term be increased to 7 years, and this is for the committee to decide whether it agrees with this. With regard to remunerations in paragraph 42, the bill provides that the remunerations and terms and conditions of service on the ombud and the deputy military ombud are determined by the president in concurrence with the Minister of Finance. The salary of the military ombud is fixed to that of a high court judge, while the deputy is fixed to that of 80% of the ombud's salary. It is our submission that this is in line with international best practice, that the salary of the ombud is fixed, especially to that of a judge. This is similar to the current position with the public protector. We do observe, however, that the terms and conditions of employment, or what is referred to as the service conditions of the ombud, are not fixed for the duration of the term. In terms of international guidelines, it is suggested that the terms and conditions also be fixed for the duration of the term. In terms of, I now refer to paragraph 45, regarding the removal of the ombud from office. The bill sets out a procedure wherein the president has the sole discretion to remove the ombud after giving the ombud an opportunity to be heard. This discretion lies solely with the president and may create the perception that the ombud may have to be playing to the president, and if the committee agrees with the view, it is suggested that they consider including a role for Parliament in the removal of the ombud, and this will create a far more fair and independent process. We suggest in paragraph 48 an alternate procedure, which says the president removes the military ombud on the recommendation of the National Assembly. I now refer to clause 6, powers and functions of the ombud. And I'm going to refer specifically to clause 6.6, which empowers the military ombud to order the department to comply with the determination or the alternative determination. We submit that traditionally an ombud makes recommendations and does not have the power to comply to compel the department to meet these recommendations. This is something that is not found with the traditional ombud. We refer to clause 6.9, which provides the minister may assign to the ombud any other additional functions which are not consistent with the act. It is our submission that this discretion is very wide and is done without consultation of the ombud and the legislature. We submit that it would be better for the ombud's powers and functions to be clearly defined and not be open to easy alteration. This will protect the independence of the ombud. We refer to clause 7 in paragraph 52, and we note that this sets out in detail the areas that where the jurisdiction of the ombud is limited. As stated before, we also submit that there should be a clause that details the jurisdiction of the ombud. I refer to clause 8, which deals with independence and impartiality. That is in paragraph 53. We note that clauses 8, 1 to 4 provide important protections to ensure the independence of the ombud. However, we note clause 8, 4 provides that members and employees of the department must cooperate with the ombud. And in 8.5, the ombud must preserve the confidentiality of this information. So firstly, the department and its officials must cooperate with the ombud, and in turn, the ombud must preserve the confidence of this information. However, if we refer to clause 4.2 in the offences section, we note that failure to comply with, failure to keep the confidential keep the information confidential is an offence, which is has a possible sentence of 12 months. So, if the ombud releases confidential information, there is a possibility of this criminal sanction. And we are of the opinion that this is quite onerous on the ombud. It will prevent free and transparent investigations and may not enable him to conduct his work independently. With regard to staff in clause 9, we note that the ombud must appoint staff after consulting with the minister. It is our view that this may be seen as interference by the minister, and we suggest that the ombud has the sole discretion to appoint staff. This will also be more practical and enable the staff, the ombud to create an office that is able to carry out his mandate and be loyal to the ombud in carrying out sensitive work. Clause 10, which deals with finances, we note that there has been concern expressed by various commentators and academics as to regarding the financing of independent institutions such as our Chapter 9. We just make a note of this, and this is for the committee's consideration. I refer to clause 11, which deals with reporting, in paragraph 66. Clause 11.2 requires that the ombud directly report to the minister on activities as and when requested by the minister. It is our submission that this discretion is on the part of the minister is very wide and may be construed by some as being interference by the minister. In paragraph 67, we also acknowledge there may be legitimate reasons for the minister to have knowledge of the work of the ombud, and there needs to be a relationship between both the minister and the ombud. It is therefore our opinion that the discretion may, or the wording of the section may be couched better to ensure that the discretion is not so wide. With regard to clause 12, the disestablishment of the ombud, we acknowledge that this section does protect the ombud, as an act of parliament can only disestablish the ombud. With regard to clause 14, offences and penalties, as I noted, clause 8.5 may be onerous on the ombud. With regard to the regulations in clause 15, paragraph 73, at present, the bill states that regulations may be made by the minister after consulting with the ombud. It is our submission that the regulation goes to the heart of the functioning of the ombud. The particular powers given to the minister in terms of the bill will directly impact on how the ombud carries out its daily functioning. And we therefore suggest or submit that Parliament may consider having a role in this to ensure that this is the regulations are not too onerous or don't impact on the independence of the ombud, and therefore we suggest that the regulations be tabled and approved by Parliament. In conclusion, we note the current bill seeks to create an ombud that is independent and impartial. To ensure that the bill gives effect to this intention, the committee may consider further entrenching this independence. It is submitted that special consideration be given to the following aspects: the appointment and removal procedures of the ombud, the appointment of staff, the reporting lines between the ombud and the minister, as well as committee consider exercising oversight over the regulations. Thank you, Chair.
Sorry, Chair. I'd like just to conclude by contextualizing the opinion. Honorable Chair and members of the committee, the opinion does not seek to prescribe to the committee what to do. However, the opinion intends to enable members to make decisions that are informed and legally compliant. We make these recommendations in full view of the fact that it is the committee that ultimately makes decisions. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Before I give members an opportunity to comment and ask questions, can you just please repeat the clause 11 reporting? Okay.
Well, while she's looking at that particular clause, Chair, our view on the reporting line is that for this body to be seen to be independent, the way that the bill is currently crafted raises concerns that there could be potential for interference with the operations of the ombuds. But we say so in not ignoring the reality that there is a need for a relationship between the military ombud and the minister, for the simple reason that the minister, as the political head of the department, has a responsibility to run the department efficiently. And we see the ombud not as a counter force to the department, but as an enabling body ensuring that the minister discharges her constitutional obligation. I'll demonstrate this by way of an example. The complaints mechanism is preceded by an internal process in that, let's say, a member of the Defense Force who's got a complaint relating to his or her service benefits must lodge either a complaint and follow the internal process. It is only when that process fails that the matter then goes to the ombud. Now, if, for instance, the ombud in his or her report indicates or finds that 80% of matters that come to his or her office are matters that should have been dealt with within the internal processes of the department. Clearly, it says there is a systematic problem within the department, and therefore, it is in the interest of the department or the political head that he or she is appraised of such a development so that she can take appropriate action. So we say it is an area that needs to be carefully looked at. On the one hand, you don't want to create an impression that this body reports to the minister on its operations. On the other hand, you need to balance that with the reality that the minister is the political head and she has a constitutional obligation towards the department. I don't know if that answers your query.
What is your recommendation?
Honorable Chair, our recommendation is that the Ombuds report to Parliament, not to the Minister, that the a provision be created in the bill that the reports of the Ombuds on its investigation be made available to the Minister. I think that that will take care of this particular challenge.
Thank you very much. Honorable Member, Honorable Meneer.
Thank you, Chair. Let me just begin by thanking the Parliamentary Law Advisors for providing us with this legal opinion. It is 16 pages long and contains 75 footnotes. I'm sure it was an enormous task to prepare the legal opinion, and thank you for that. I think it will achieve its objective, which, as you say, is to enable the committee to properly deliberate on the bill. My first question really refers to paragraph 27 of your opinion, where you really set up the question. And the question you set up is whether the provisions of the bill create a military ombud that is adequately independent to fulfill its mandate. That is essentially the question you're asking. My question to you is, what is the answer? Is the military ombudsman in your, as provided for in this bill, in your considered opinion, adequately independent to fulfill its mandate? Yes or no?
Honorable Nana. Thanks, Chairperson. Without really belaboring one point, may I also thank the legal team from Parliament for a job well done, and also commend you, Chair, for wise counseling this far. Chair, mine is will be very brief. Can I check with our legal team whether they have done a comparison in relation to the appointment of the military ombuds, a comparison to similar bodies that discharge not necessarily similar responsibilities, but that are charged with critical responsibilities as the military ombuds. Have you conducted some comparison in the appointments? Who would normally appoint such a body? I take note of your recommendations, but can I check who in your view normally appoint such bodies? And secondly, have you your proposed remuneration for the ombuds and his or her deputy? I see you have benchmarked it against a judge of the High Court. What is your basis? Are other bodies performing similar or functions remunerated as such? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Nana. Honorable Masango?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, mine is just about a complaint. A complaint is just anything that we call a complaint. I'm just wondering whether are we not going to create something that all complaints are just going to go direct to the ombudsman, not being dealt internally by the department. And if it happens that they are dealt by internal, anyone who feels every time is not, even if it is fair that the internal is dealt well, anyone is going to go to the ombudsman every time he feels no, the department is, I don't agree with this one. How are we going to ensure that this is not going to become an appeal place where people just go there anytime they are not happy with the department?
Thank you very much, the legal team.
Thank you, honorable members, for the questions. The first question that Honorable Meunier raised, which he requires a yes or no response. as I indicated when closing our presentation, that when we give opinions, we don't want to be prescriptive. On the other hand, we don't see ourselves as judges. We see ourselves as advisors. We want to enrich the process rather than being critical of the process. The approach that we've adopted in our advice was to indicate those areas in the bill where we think for the bill to be sufficiently independent, they need to be strengthened, and we made recommendations to that effect. And we did that acknowledging that this is still a process. We're not certifying a bill that is ready to be assented to by the president. So, yes, we did find areas where the bill could be strengthened, and we did find areas where we think some of the provisions of the bill do meet the test of independence. However, for the bill to be completely, or for the office to be entirely independent, you'll have to look at the entire provisions of the bill, not only those that are lacking or those that are sufficient. Thank you, sir. I think my colleague will then deal with the issue of the second question relating to the comparison.
Honourable Member, with regard to a comparison, I did look at the researcher's documentation, wherein he did quite an extensive comparison. I note that there are various procedures for appointment of an ombud. Some countries appoint an ombud to the executive. Some use the parliamentary process. I think Germany has a very open process where the person must be nominated or elected, sort of. So there's various processes. But the question is, what is most suitable for South Africa? And I found it more appropriate to benchmark it against our current ombuds, such as the public protector, as opposed to looking at international comparisons because of our constitutional framework. With regard to the question of the judges' remuneration, honourable member, this is already in the bill. So the bill states that the ombud must be paid according to the salary of the judge, and this is in line with international practice. The public protector is paid the salary of the judge. With regard to complaints as to whether the ombud will become a body where people who do not get satisfaction initially lodge their complaints, in clause 7D, it states that a member must first use the internal grievance regulations, and the ombud will not be able to investigate a complaint until the internal process has been dealt with. There's always that danger that this body may become such, but by creating the structure, it is for the purpose where people who are not satisfied with the initial complaints have an outlet where to lodge further complaints.
Just to add on the last question relating to complaints, perhaps it might be a burden for the ombud to if everybody now who is not happy with the ruling by the department runs to the ombud. However, the net effect thereof is a positive, because when you have had an independent person that you have confidence in his or her process, when you were initially reluctant to accept the ruling that was against you, you might be susceptible to accepting his or her ruling, which then goes to the core of the morale of the employee, because what you want at the end of the day is a satisfaction, is to sit with an employee that although his or her complaint was not answered to his satisfaction, but the process, there is assurance that somebody independent had looked at the issue and has ruled against him. So in brief, I think although there is that potential of influx of complaints to the ombud, there is also a long-lasting benefit. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other question, any other comment? Honorable Mkabadeli, Honorable Daniels, Honorable Munir.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks to the advisors. Thank you very much to the advisors. Mine won't be a question that needs an answer from the advisors, but maybe from the Chair, not because I think you are carrying a bag full of answers, but because what the advisors have given us, it creates much more need for us to know. One, to know the time frame for this bill to be passed. How urgent are we pushed for this bill? Are we just discussing it for us to know for how long? So linked to that, do we really at this juncture need the ombudsman? Or is just the education, we're giving an education about the ombudsman? Do we really need it? Also, where does the buck stop when it comes to what we're discussing here? Where does the buck stop? After we've discussed, when we look at the independence and the accountability and whatever, where will what we're discussing here be taken to the president, to the minister, to who, in order to do what? Will we be afforded an opportunity, because there is parliament also here as an independent, a body that can exercise, will you be afforded an opportunity to discuss this with the minister? I know sometimes we in parliament are not taken that much serious by the community of our country. We are taken, we are not taken serious when it suits us, we are taken serious when... Are we going to be afforded an opportunity to discuss these things with the minister, with the president? We are not accountable to any other president, but to the president, because there is a president here appointing. There is also an issue of the minister. There is also an issue of parliament. I'm asking this question based on the uniqueness of the military as such and its content. That's why I said my question, my contribution is not going to be a straightforward question, but I'm looking at what has been presented, which even opens much more need for us to know how urgent are we pushed with this bill. What is the time frame? And where does the buck stop? Thank you.
Honorable Daniel.
Thank you, Chair. I'm also welcoming the information that we've just been given. But just one thing, Chair, on the definition, I one see where it talks about complaint. On one see, it says a member of the public regarding the conduct of a member of the defense. Now, this is very interesting. So a member of the public jumping the department and going straight to the ombudsman. I just want to check, isn't it supposed to be a member of the public reporting a member of defense, because really for you to know that a person is a member of the defense, must be a person, I'm assuming, must be in uniform, unless otherwise you know for a fact that a person is a member of the defense. And shouldn't the department be dealing with that before it goes to the ombudsman? Because there must be a previous procedure in the defense that deals with such things. At what point does a member of the party, public in this particular instance, goes to the public, the ministry ombudsman, whilst the department is there and is meant to deal with its own members, outside the other issues that a person can go to the ministry ombudsman? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Before I ask my second question, let me make a comment in response to the Honourable Mkhabadeli. I mean, we absolutely do need the military ombudsman. And the Minister, you will recall when she introduced the bill and briefed our committee, she indicated that we needed the military ombudsman as a matter of urgency. And I think the minister is absolutely correct, because the military ombudsman, I think, will go a long way to assist us with dealing with grievances, which we know as a result of the findings by the Interim National Defence Force Service Commission are in very poor shape. So I do think that there is an element of urgency here to set up a military ombudsman. But equally, I think then the military ombudsman needs to be institutionally independent, and we need to amend this bill so that it passes the test of institutional independence. And that's why this legal opinion, I think, will be so useful in our deliberations going forward. But I would be very concerned if there was anything that we did to delay this bill. We need to do everything we can to ensure that it is enacted before the end of the year. My question, Chair, comes again to the question of independence. One thing that I am concerned about, and the legal advisors have dealt with the appointment of the military ombudsman. The whole question of whether, if the military ombudsman was a former military officer, would that necessarily compromise the independence of the military ombudsman? I say that because, precisely for the reason that the department said, the department made the point that there's a very strong military culture. It would seem to me that if the military ombudsman were a former senior officer, for example, a retired general, there may be actual bias, or the danger of actual bias, but also the perception of bias. And so it would seem to me that this raises a question about whether the military ombudsman should be a former serving officer. My question is this. If the military ombudsman were a former military officer, would that affect the independence of the military ombudsman?
Thank you very much, many of the honourable members, the honourable Mkhabadeli. You must not forget that this bill emanates from this committee. As to whether we need the ombudsman or not is no more a question. I think there is a general agreement that we need that because of the reason that you have mentioned, that the uniqueness of the military. we are lawmakers and this is our bill. There is nobody who must push us. There are no set targets, but the targets which are there, but we must set them, set them ourselves because we are lawmakers. The reason that we must invite the department here, we have identified the department as part of the stakeholders, not that they are here to run the bill, it's our bill. So that they must also give us their understanding of the bill and give advice. It doesn't mean that if it's our bill, we must not sought the advice of the all the stakeholders. I think that is the... Thank you very much. Can we have legal advisors?
Thank you, Chair. Again, on the issue of the definition in 1C, I think perhaps the department will be in a better position to respond to that particular question. However, our view is that currently, in the absence of this bill, the public protector has got powers to investigate complaints against members of the defense or from members of the public. And there's no requirement that a member of the public first approaches the department with the complaint. That's all that I just wanted to bring to the attention of the committee. And perhaps then the department would help me out in that regard. With regard to Honorable Maynard's question of whether a former senior officer appointed as the ombud will create a perception of bias, I must confess it is quite a tricky question, but the Constitutional Court, I was looking at the opinion. Sometimes we write a number of opinions. And I seem to recall a case that I dealt with recently where the Constitutional Court came out clearly and say where you come from does not necessarily have a bearing on the position you're to occupy. This was in reference to the appointment of judges. I think the court made a remark that we cannot rule out, the court said, most if not all of the current recruits to the judiciary must have had political affiliation at some stage of their life, particularly pre-1994. And therefore, it would be a sad day if that particular candidate's appropriateness for appointment to the judiciary would be judged on what he or she had done before that. So I think then that should answer the question. There might be a perception, but I, in relying on that judgment, I would say it would not be a justifiable perception.
Honorable Diale, Honorable Nana.
Honorable Chair, I raised my hand to say I'm in agreement with the formation or creation of an institution like this. I want to say whereby our defense force will be able to convey the grievances into. Now, but what I don't understand is the fact that the word public is a broad. Now, what do we mean by public? Public is a broad, part of our society. It's anybody in public, after hearing that there is such organ, can go to report the matter. Is that the, is what we say? I want to know.
You're talking about public perception in this document.
On public perception.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
Honorable Nana. Thanks, Chairperson. Chairperson, the legal team has made a correct observation that in clause 7 there is an omission of the scope of work. No, not the scope of work. There is an omission of the actual ground that the ombudsman should cover. But the bill does set out in clause 7 the limitation of jurisdiction, mainly covering what the ombuds may not investigate, as a complaint, but also covers what the ombuds may refuse to investigate as a complaint. Now, in your view as the legal team, don't you think this is sufficient? And for it to be sufficient, we then come to an agreement that anything that falls outside what is contained in the limitation of jurisdiction would therefore fall within the jurisdiction of the ombudsman. That's right.
Correct. The question. Let me start with the last question. I think the point we're making in our opinion about the scope of or the jurisdiction of the military ombud is that in our view, for this body to be sufficiently independent, it needs to be empowered to investigate what falls within its jurisdiction on its own at times, not necessarily be responsive or to be reactionary, but to also be proactive. I think that is the point that we're making in our opinion. We take the point that, yes, the jurisdiction is clearly defined. However, if this body cannot on its own conduct investigations, we're of the view that it could be a limitation. On the second or the first question rather that I'm answering about public, I'm not sure whether there's reference to members of the public.
In public perception. About
public perception would be a member of the public holding a particular view about the structure. In this instance, what will be important will be those people who have their cases or their faith to be decided by this particular ombud. I mean, if I am a member of the defense force, I have a complaint that I feel is not being adequately attended to by the department. When I look at this particular structure called military ombuds, does it inspire sufficient confidence? Does it encourage me to, one, lodge the complaint? Secondly, do I have confidence, once I've lodged the complaint, that the processes are such that I will live with the outcome of this particular body. I think that to me would be people that have a vested interest. They'll be members of the public. Members of the public in terms of the constitution include the media as well. So I guess that media's perception of this body would also play a role. So that to me would basically be the response to the question of public perception. I think my colleague has one addition to make.
Just to add to Bernard, okay, you're not talking about just oversensitive members of the public when you talk about public perception. It's an objective test, and it talks about the reasonable member of society taking into consideration our society is diverse. So the test is objective. And further, with regarding to the jurisdiction of the ombuds with respect to Clause 7, the point is that the limitations of the jurisdiction are clearly set out. It is our opinion that the jurisdiction itself must also be clearly set out.
Thank you very much.
I think members have exhausted all the questions that they had and the comments. Now we will use these documents and other documents. There are a lot of legal presentations here. The department made its own presentation. Now the parliamentary legal advisors did their own. We will use this as a guideline when we are going to consider clause by clause of the bill. So I urge members to go on and acquaint themselves with this presentation so that you should make informed contribution when we deal with this bill. We do not have any other thing on the agenda. There is an announcement by Honorable Nana.
Except to say, Chair, on the 10th, we're playing against Barrett.
Who are you?
Here at you.
Okay.
Well, it's got to tell you, Chair. Well, I'm looking forward to
the meeting is adjourned. Honorable Diale has written a book there, which is being sold. Then if you want to buy that book, just go there and get the experience of a veteran. Honorable Diala, I'll bring the invoice for marketing. Honorable Mania?
Chair, I'm not sure if I recall correctly, but I understood the department were also going to provide us with an explanation for their policy choices. I know that we don't have the we have the legal team here, not the policy team. But if I recall correctly, last week or the week before last, there was some agreement that the department were going to present us with an analysis of the policy, why it is they had chosen an executive as opposed to a parliamentary model. I might recall incorrectly.
Okay.
Do you remember that? I don't remember anything like that. Do you?
The question was posed last week. And we have your message when the committee is ready, we will come and prepare. Of course, through our meetings, we will be happy to come. So we really in your hands and you are willing to
Chair, the crisp question, and I say this with in a lighter vein, the crisp question for the department is why they decided to deliver a tiger without peace.
Okay, thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.
Oh.
What is the difference? What are we going to do? Oh.